Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are glad that you are with us today. Later on in today's show, we'll hear from Dr. Tom Easern in another of his great Plainsfolk essays. It's Wednesday. That means it's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. We have a professional mixologist in our Main Street studio. He'll tell us everything we need to know to mix those perfect summertime drinks. And we'll go inside the Bowhead Well census in Alaska. And Main Street begins today here with Jill Reese. We're going to talk about the 33rd annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival, which will be held at Cross Ranch State Park on June 13th and 14th. That's Friday and Saturday coming up. Jill, welcome back to Main Street. Holy cow. Live bluegrass music, workshops, and other activities. What more could you ask for?
Oh, we got a lot going on this weekend. We're actually going to start Friday, June 13th, and we're going to start at 6:30 and go till 10:30. And then we're going to gear up on Saturday morning and have an open stage at 10 a.m. until 11. And that's really fun because people will have the full sound system set up and you can get up and play a song or maybe something you wrote or get some friends together and play on the open stage. And then we start playing from 11 a.m. Until about 9:30 Saturday night or whenever they kick us off the stage or something like that. I have a special friend here from East Tennessee, the Knoxville area. Her name is Evie Andrus. Just graduated with her master's degree in musicology. She's a teacher. Evie. Yeah, teacher, player. I want her to visit a little bit with you too here, Craig.
Evie, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. I actually grew up in North Dakota, and my dad was the one that was running the Bluegrass Festival for many years before Jill and Cottonwood took it over. So it's real good to be home and hanging out and going back out to Cross Ranch. It's just a beautiful spot to be listening to some bluegrass music on the weekend.
Jill, what's the lineup? There'll be multiple bluegrass bands.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. We do. And actually, five of the six bands are all from North Dakota. So that's really kind of exciting this year. And we have our headline band. One of them is Kenny and Amanda Smith Band from Nashville, Tennessee. We've been trying to get them to the festival for a number of years, and it seemed to work out. The stars aligned.
And then, of course, we've got the Waddingtons and then the Blue Stems, which we have a good number of them in the studio with us today. And then we've got Kohlrabi Soup from Fargo, Flat Mountain Drive from right around the Bismarck-Mandan area, and, of course, Cottonwood from Washburn. So lots of great music coming at you from all around the state of North Dakota and some from Tennessee.
It sounds so much fun. There is some admission on Friday and Saturday, Jill, and for the weekend. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a Friday night, it's $20 to get in. And just always remember, kids 16 and under are free. So bring all the kids and all the neighbors' kids. And then Saturday, it's $35. And if you come both days, it's $45. Most of the electric campsites are booked, but there's a huge overflow area for camping. But come in and get a spot before we fill up, because that area usually tends to fill up as well.
Evie, what is your expertise when it comes to bluegrass?
Oh, well, I'm a fiddle player by trade. I went to East Tennessee State University and minored in bluegrass and have been performing in and around the East Tennessee region professionally for the last 15, 16 years now. But I grew up here in North Dakota, grew up in Minot, playing in a family bluegrass band with my dad and my brother, who are both will be out at the festival playing this weekend too. And like any good daughter, I am my father's daughter in that I started a bluegrass association down in East Tennessee called the East Tennessee Bluegrass Association. And my dad runs the Bluegrass Association of North Dakota here, band, which helps put on the festival and a bunch of jams and workshops throughout the year, too. So I guess you could say it's in my blood and in my lineage, and I come by it honestly.
Yeah, you could have chosen to do lots of other things, right? You could have gotten into, I don't know, country, rock and roll. What grabs you about bluegrass? What is it that hooks you?
Well, I think one of the biggest things, and we've kind of been talking about this all day, is it's the community, man. It's the bluegrass is such a communal type of music. And you think about the history of bluegrass and where it came from. It comes from, a lot of community events such as dances or barn gatherings and things like that. So it's very much a music that is designed for people to be playing together and to join together. And it's just, you know, it's just fun. And it has provided me with so many opportunities in this life to play and to travel. And it's really helped me as a musician grow to be able to play other styles as well, because bluegrass is at its core very improvisational music. I mean, there's some stuff written out and whatnot, but a lot of it is playing by ear, which is very valuable as a musician to have that skill set. So that translates really well into playing other, you know, I've played in everything from Irish bands to a rock band, and I even did an entire set one night with I feel like I'm making things up when I say things like this. It was like, I have this buddy that was from Russia, that's a silk aerialist, that was doing like house DJ mixing while I played live fiddle over top of it. And it was the weirdest experience of my life, but it was really cool too. So it's like, but bluegrass allowed me to have the skill set to do stuff like that. So it was really random.
I was just going to say, we're talking about the 33rd annual Missouri River Bluegrass Festival this Friday and Saturday coming up. Be held at Cross Ranch State Park. And the festival features live bluegrass music workshops and a bunch of other activities, including learn a bluegrass song, Jill.
That's
offered.
That is one of my favorite parts of the festival. And it's a 2-hour workshop. You can go for 1 hour, 2 hours. It is free. It's for all ages. And even if you don't have a fiddle or a banjo or something like that, just come and we'll give you the song sheet. You can follow along. Maybe looking at all these instruments and hearing them might even inspire you, like, I'm going to buy a mandolin or even a banjo.
Well, and one of the cool things about these workshops is these are the pros, the folks that are headlining the festival that are leading these workshops. So it's a chance to come get instruction from, you know, nationally recognized, internationally recognized talent, and in a very intimate setting that you wouldn't normally get otherwise. I mean, there's times where I've seen one-on-one lessons happening with, you know, people that have been won IBMA awards and been nominated for Grammys, and you get to come hang out at Cross Ranch and be up close and personal with them during these workshops.
In the maintenance shop.
Yeah, in the maintenance shop.
All right, Jill, okay. We have a special, special thing for our listeners right now. You have brought a band.
We do, and we're getting ready to play.
Introduce the band for us.
Okay. Well, we've got Sadie Meyer. She's a guitar player playing guitar with the Blue Stems. We have Evie Andrus on the fiddle. We have Malachi on the banjo, and he is a Meyer. He's one of the Blue Stems. And Micah is on the bass fiddle, and he is a member of the Blue Stems as well. And I'm playing a guitar.
All right. Let's hear it.
Okay.
All right. Ready? 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
clapping. This is so wonderful.
Oh, Jill, good.
For people that haven't been to Cross Ranch State Park, and it's right on the Missouri, describe it for us.
I'm a little, you know, biased and stuff. It is absolutely stunning among the cottonwood trees. It's right really on the Missouri River. There's lots of paths out there. You can walk on the river there. It's a lot of big, big, tall trees to sit under. And I don't know. I you know, it's kind of funny because a lot of folks where I live at Washburn, you know, have never been there. And it's funny how when you live near something, you don't go to that place, but you go 3,000 miles away to that place. And so it's always such a surprise, I think, when people, you know, get out there and like, oh, wow, it's so beautiful. Great place to camp. You know, there's a nice visitor center for little kids to run around in. And it's nice shower houses for the park. And it's just beautiful, beautiful state park.
And it's one of the things that I love about it, too, is especially where we hang out at, it's just you're surrounded. We're right kind of by where the train trestle goes by. So you got big old hill on one side, and you just kind of nestled in down there.
Yep.
And it's a great place to just get away and kind of step away from the busyness of everyday life and just go and enjoy nature. And again, this, especially bluegrass music, just fits so well out in that setting and in that place. And it just kind of allows you to disconnect a little bit.
Yeah.
In a way, when you're out there, you don't get that good a reception, and it's kind of perfect that you just, you know, get to unplug for a little bit and enjoy the company of others and listen to some good tunes.
Yeah, it sure is. Park staff is busy this week, you know, mowing everything up and very, very cleaning the maintenance shop, because we kind of take over there, you know. If we have a lightning storm or anything and we have to shut electrical off, we all grab a lawn chair and head over to the maintenance shop, and that's where the concert goes on, you know, as a backup as well. Hopefully that's not going to happen. Evie always mentions too, you want to bring an umbrella, you know, so it won't rain, and then maybe some sunscreen and lawn chair and some bug spray. And we encourage everybody to bring cash if you can, because sometimes our little card reader doesn't always work. So we just look forward to seeing everybody this weekend. It's going to be just amazing music, jamming at night. There'll be some jamming in the maintenance shop right away Friday night after the stage show is done at 10:30. So you might want to wander over there and hang out too. Oh, Kimmy's Catering is on site from Beulah, and I know she's having Fleischkekle and mini donuts.
Jill and Evie and the band, thank you so much for joining us. We've been visiting about the Missouri River Bluegrass Festival. It's this weekend. The event starts Friday, June 13th at 6:30 p.m., and late Saturday night, depending on how long everyone plays, it's at Cross Ranch State Park. Everybody is welcome. There is an admission fee for those folks who are over 16 years old. We certainly hope everyone can attend. And now, Jill Weiss and Evie Andrus, if you want to take us out with some more great bluegrass music, the bluegrass stage in the Cramped Main Street Studio is all yours.
Thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're going to have Malachi come on up here and kick off a little bit of Clinch Mountain Backstep in the key of A for those of you keeping track out there. Take it away, buddy.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2025 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this episode of Plainsfolk, historian Dr. Tom Ezern explores the complex legacy of ethnic identity through the lens of North Dakota's 1906 Setten de Mai celebrations. What begins as an alarming encounter with white supremacist rhetoric evolves into a deeper reflection on cultural pride, artistic heritage, and the enduring challenge of defining true patriotism.
Reading the documents on the rise of Sitting to Mai celebrations in North Dakota in 1906, I was more than a little alarmed at the themes and tropes that emerged. In matters of ethnic identity, I am prepared to accept a certain measure of cultural chauvinism, but the remarks of future Senator Ozell Jorgensen Rana in Grand Forks went way beyond that. They stereotyped immigrant cultures, including his own. They invoked white supremacy, and they posed a fossilized model for immigration. We're here, we got ours, now close the door, we're done. These tropes recalled the discomfort I felt a few weeks ago when researching historic Nordic cosmology as background to my treatment of the wonderful 1919 farm ballad from West Hope, North Dakota, The Sower's Prayer. Its Swedish author, John Ferdinand Talcott, penned his stanzas, he said, after a Scandinavian idea. Reading up on Norse cosmology, I determined that what he meant was a grounded sense of place in the land based on the mythic tree of life, the Yggdrasil. Surely a wholesome thing. The more, however, I read such century-old classic works as Teutonic Mythology, Gods and Goddesses of the Northland, three volumes by Victor Rydberg, the more I saw that the revivers, translators, and promoters of Norse saga and identity in those days directly fed the out-of-control race theory represented by Grana on Sitting to Mai. So I contemplated, on the one hand, the utter grace exemplified by Talcott in his ballad, with, on the other hand, the perverse bigotries expressed by Grana in his address. Going forward from them, are we good? Might a virtuous, constructive species of ethnic identity prevail? The answer begins already in other proceedings of the Sitting to Mai 1906 celebration in Grand Forks. Speakers invoked Vermont's great bibliophile and naturalist George Perkins Marsh to fashion a sound strategy for immigrant Americans in waiting. Demonstrate that you exemplify American values, whatever those might be, better than Americans themselves do. This sort of cultural positioning has worked for three generations ever since. Another good piece of advice at the time, follow the lead of Thomas Dougal Varlow of the Chicago Norske Club, who in his speeches in North Dakota embraced the New Norway. He, along with other Norwegian cultural ambassadors, called on Norwegian Americans to shun all that was coarse or tawdry and thus burnish the luster of the homeland. Norwegians there and here proceeded to fashion a mythic nation, not on animus or conflict, but on arts and letters, a country made by Ossen, Grieg, Ibsen, Bjornsen, and Wergeland. It turns out artists and intellectuals make great statues. Surely Willa Cather, who more than any other Anglo-American credited immigrants for their contributions to life on the plains, would be pleased. In fact, Grana himself made the argument for treasuring Norwegian culture for what it was. "There is no greater misunderstanding," he declares, "than that a Norwegian is to put aside all his Norse character when he comes to this country. And in no case should he forget his own language, for therein lies a country's greatness. A person who would do this cannot be a true patriot of the United States." In citizenship ceremonies for new Americans, just across the street from Kringen Lodge of the Sons of Norway, I have said the same thing. I have to admit, Grana said it better than 1906. When the better angels speak, give ear.
That was our good friend, Dr. Tom Ezern. He weekly shares with us his Plains Folk essays, and we're grateful. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is having unexpected impacts across indigenous land. In the Arctic, scientists and Alaska Native hunters have been counting bowhead whales. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden reports that less sea ice seems to be leading to more whales, but warmer temperatures could come with other consequences for both researchers and the large marine mammals.
When bowhead whales pass Utqiagvik on their way up north, it's a good time to count them. These calls, recorded with an underwater microphone, were from whales swimming there last month. Every 10 years, scientists and local hunters team up to carry out the census for bowhead whales that migrate between the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. North Slope Borough biologist John Sitta says the data helps ensure that the bowhead population is healthy. It's also used to set subsistence harvest limits in the years to come.
We do it for the whaling captains, and we do it in collaboration with them. You know, they've taught us how to be on the ice safely.
First, they build a perch on the sea ice, right on the edge with a stretch of an open water or lead. Observers have been climbing the perch and counting the whales passing by since the beginning of April, when the census started. The visual count continues throughout the spring bowhead migration and is only the first step of the census. Scientists will also need to statistically adjust the data. But so far, Sitta says the final estimate might be around 20,000 whales or more, a significant increase since the last census numbers, which were released in 2019.
Yeah, so we think there are a lot more whales out there now than what there used to be, and that we suspect the populations continue to grow, but we just don't know that for certain yet.
Sitta says the bowheads might be thriving because the sea ice in the Arctic is declining. The change in conditions can also lead to more competition with humpbacks, predation from killer whales, or collisions with ships. Sitta says the only way to know is to continue to monitor the population. Whalers in the Arctic have been involved in the bowhead census since the early 70s. That's when the International Whaling Commission, an organization that regulates whaling, counted whales for the first time. That estimate was so low that the commission reduced the harvest. The hunters objected to the limitations and asked for another census. Retired whale biologist Geoff Carroll co-led subsequent counts.
We're able to improve our techniques over the years. We're able to show that there's plenty of bowheads to support the subsistence hunt.
That initial count only included whales passing through the stretch of open water. But hunters knew that some animals traveled far from shore or under thick ice. Throughout the years, the census has included acoustic and aerial surveys that account for those whales. This year, the acoustic part of the count is also happening. Scientists place hydrophones, underwater devices that record ocean sounds, at the bottom of the sea and will retrieve them this fall. They will use the recordings to see how many whales passed through the area, says Carol, who is also an advisor for this year's census.
It turns out that bowhead whales really talk a lot when they're migrating, and so that works out very well with the hydrophones.
Biologists will also fly above the Beaufort Sea and photograph breaching whales later this summer as part of an aerial survey. Sitta says that with sea ice becoming less stable each year, counting whales from a perch is getting more dangerous.
We're afraid that due to changes in sea ice and sea ice being around for a shorter period of time and being less safe to be on for a long period of time, we're worried that those counts will not be a viable way to count bowheads in the future. And if that's the case, we need alternatives. And one of the leading alternatives is an aerial survey.
After the count is done, scientists will need to process the data, which can take up to 2 years. The International Whaling Commission expects the final estimate in 2029 to decide whether to renew the region's current subsistence whaling quota. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
I like bagels. eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
The music that greets us each and every Wednesday means it's time for Prairie Plates with my good friend Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. We're not talking plates today. We're talking drinks.
That works for me. Summertime, lemonade, cocktails. Elijah Larson is with us today. Elijah, welcome to Main Street.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Rick tells me you are a pro-level mixologist. Give me your history, Elijah.
I've been in the bar and restaurant industry for just about 23 years. I started as a bar back when I got out of the service and did volume dive bars for about a decade. And then I hopped into kind of the restaurant area, started consulting, helping open different restaurants and bars throughout the region.
So when you consult and when you decide what drinks to offer, what goes through your mind?
A lot of the drink recipes will be based on like the style of restaurant and the style of food they're doing.
And before I turn it over to Rick, Elijah, I'm going to give you one drink that you can have for the rest of your life, and that's it. Only one. What are you going to make yourself?
That's a good question.
H2O.
Okay, now, come on. Besides that, something cool and fun.
Probably a shot of mezcal.
Well, Elijah, we've known each other for quite a while, and you've worked at a few places, mostly in the downtown area, and you've opened up quite a few places and done some consulting. And how has the cocktail scene developed in Fargo over the years? You've been around and you've seen a lot of changes. What are your thoughts there?
It's gotten a lot more creative. There's far more bartenders now using that part of the skill set than there were 10, 15 years ago. More interesting ingredients, fresher ingredients, and better education. Like, people are actually cracking books and learning and studying from other folks that are on the internet and things like that.
It's been really neat to see. And are there any favorite cocktails of yours to make?
And does it vary by season?
My personal choice is not so much. I think people should drink what they want when they want, necessarily, for the most part. My favorite drinks to make, I mean, I love, like, the classic formulas, old fashions and Manhattans. There's countless ways that you can modify and adjust those into seasonal things or just to play with, you know. Less is more a lot of times.
Do you focus more on good ingredients? Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, I prefer to work with like at the very least a mid-tier style bottle, you know. You can make cocktails out of almost anything, but...
Yes.
You know, the better the ingredient, the better the outcome of the drink.
And as far as... warm weather cocktails, typically, are there a few that you really enjoy or really like to make?
Yeah, things that I would enjoy drinking, like in a hot day, things like Aperol Spritz or Hugo Spritzes. They're pretty easy cocktails.
Very popular right now. Yes,
very popular right now. Again, French 75s. Those are easily twistable into seasonal drinks, things like that. And then sours, margaritas, stuff like that. I'm a big fan of like playing with teas. So doing like bourbon teas, you can do like a lighter bourbon and a nice tea and then infuse that with cucumber and mint and things like that, you know.
Cucumber drinks seem to be popular right now too. Are there some spirits that would pair well with those?
Gin is probably your go-to. I mean, a ribbon of cucumber and a muddled cucumber and just a gin and soda is fantastic.
Elijah, if I were going to elevate my home bartending game, what would you recommend? Maybe three essential spirits or liqueurs that you think I ought to stock up on so I can be in the game.
Three bottles, a nice high-proof bourbon. Doesn't need to be overproof. Doesn't need like 100 proof or anything like that. But something above 90 proof that works, going to work well for like an old-fashioned style drink, a spirit for a drink. And then it'll still work for like an acidic drink, like a sour, whiskey sour, where that bourbon's still going to be present. Bitters, you always got to have bitters. And then... for me, I would probably go with like a good bottle of tequila or a good bottle of gin.
I like both. I don't discriminate.
Taste everything.
Yeah, you gotta taste everything. And I really like gins that are a little more like on the rose petal cucumber side, but there's others that like gins on the juniper side, which are good too. If they're really heavy on the juniper, I think people start running away sometimes, but some people really like that flavor. So, and tequila, mezcal... I like the smokiness of mezcal. I think that's what people pick up on mostly. But a good tequila, mid-level tequila, you really can't go wrong with. And just mixing it with lime juice, obviously, is kind of classic. But I don't know. I know enough to be dangerous, but I'm not a professional level bartender by any means. So correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, this time of year, I mean, like almost any spirit, is not, just adding bubbles, some sort of carbonated water, whether it's a like an actual soda water or a seltzer or a soda pop, and then balancing that with your acid and bitters, like those are probably your best options for summertime. Something that's going to be light, bubbly, make sure it's super cold.
And I know this is kind of a dumb question, but shaken versus stirred, bruised liquor, that sort of thing. I'm not an expert when it comes to this, but you are, and that's why we're having you in.
So you shake drinks when you need to aerate, and aeration happens during a shake, and things that need to be shaken would be things with creams, cream liqueurs, acids, heavy syrups. So like margaritas, daiquiris, things of that nature need to be shaken, and all the variations of those sour drinks.
We've talked about mocktails quite a lot.
Yes.
On our show.
Yes.
And Elijah, I think maybe those are becoming more popular. Is that what you see? And do you have some favorite mocktails you like to steer towards?
Yeah, the zero proof beverages have been like trending pretty heavily for the last couple of years. I think that comes from like the newer generation doesn't drink like the previous generations do, which is probably a good thing. I don't have any specific like go-to mocktails I make. It kind of depends on what the bar has prepped or if the bar has something pre-written for that kind of stuff. Personally, there are brands that I lean to for modifying mocktails. Like there's a couple brands of bitters out there that are made from glycerin versus like a high-proof alcohol. So then those glycerin bitters are obviously non-alcoholic, so they tend to lean better towards those NA drinks. This time of year, I still work like the teas and acids and some of those flavored bitters from the Fee Brothers line, if I can say what brand I usually use for those things.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to ask you about bitters.
Yeah, Fee Brothers is,
yes,
all their bitters are glycerin, so it's all alcohol-free.
I think our listeners would enjoy any recommendations to get up their game a little bit.
Yeah. We've seen the great bartenders in movies, all of us have, and some of them really go to town and they have a style. Right, and they're flipping bottles around and all that kind of stuff. What's your style, if I were to ask you, Elijah?
I'm very, very keyed into just like techniques that make me more efficient during cocktail build. So cross building, like if I have a drink ticket with 5 tickets in it, every container that I'm going to use to make that drink is going to be set up right away. And I'm going to put every ingredient, like 3 of them have lime juice, boom, 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 those 3 are getting lime juice right away. I'm going to build them up at the same time. And then same thing with like pouring techniques, anything that's going to make me efficient and honestly just kind of keep my area cleaner.
So you're more pragmatic maybe than a performance based.
Yeah. I've never really done flair. Like I'll flip a tin or something every once in a while, but I'm not as proficient as that I am with other techniques.
If I did that, Rick, it would be on the floor.
It still happens.
Yeah.
Somebody had to catch one of my tins the other day across the bar.
You know, what's it like? You've worked at some of the, I think, best bars in downtown Fargo, and these places get busy. What's it like for a bartender when you've got, I don't know, 10 tickets up and you're really going with 2 or 3 other guys? It's got to be a rush.
It's fun. Communication is key. I mean, the staff sets the pace. You know, you can only make so many cocktails in X amount of minutes. So communicating with your crew and your staff and just being organized, making sure those bottles are getting put back exactly the same spots. You're not wasting time looking for things, you know, the mise en place, as you would like in a French kitchen.
Yes, exactly.
Everything has its place.
And I should correct myself. There are a lot of good female bartenders as well. I just said guys, and it's not all guys. There are some very good female bartenders out there as well.
What is the ratio? If you were to tell me people that want to become really good in a bar, really serve their customers well, is there a ratio of men to women in the business?
I'm not really sure, I guess. I mean, in this market, it's got to be getting closer to 50-50, I'd imagine. I mean, most of the top bartenders in the world are females.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Most successful bartenders are females.
Yeah.
Any special events you're doing this summer, Elijah?
Just some private gigs, businesses, private entities, lake parties.
So what do you enjoy the most? Like, would you rather do a wedding? Would you rather do a lake party? Just something outside and fun, low-key, high-end?
I mean, I'll do them all, but low-key, side of lake wouldn't be bad. Stack of cash.
Money talks.
Every day.
We've had a great time here on Prairie Place with Elijah Larson. He is a pro-grade mixologist. We've been talking about summer cocktails, and this is the time of year to just enjoy ourselves, be with friends, and hook up with someone like Elijah who will mix us a good cocktail, Rick.
That's right. And next week, we'll be talking about the food truck business and where to find good food trucks around. So you can stay tuned there.
Elijah, thanks so much for joining us on Prairie Plates.
It's been my pleasure, gentlemen.
Rick Dion, my friend. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good, Craig. Nice talking with you this week.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The plight of missing and murdered Indigenous people too often goes unnoticed. On this week's news podcast, Prairie Beat, we'll take a look at the collaborative effort to change that narrative.
Hey, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster, and here we are once again for another edition of Prairie Beat.
Where we take a magnifying glass to some of the headlines in the news this week. So what's on the beat this week, Danielle?
Well, our reporter Todd McDonald had an excellent report about a new task force formed to focus on missing Indigenous people.
That was the story he did after attending the G2G summit last week, right?
Yes, the G2G, or government-to-government conference, was held in Bismarck last week. It's a collaboration between tribal, state and federal governments, as well as private industry leaders. And the whole focus is to strengthen relationships with North Dakota's 5 federally recognized tribes.
Always good to see the different levels of government working with the tribes on any number of issues. The issue of missing Indigenous people is something that's deserved a lot more attention than it gets for some time now.
Absolutely. And Todd spoke to a young woman for his story named Brianna Ironroad, and she's an enrolled member at Standing Rock. But one of the things she talked about was how awareness helps when it comes to this issue, but action is what's needed next.
A lot more of emphasis is being shown onto the matter, so I feel like that is important as well. But I also do believe that those conversations are important to have, otherwise it's going to get no effort behind it, and, you know, it doesn't move much, so.
Yeah, attention is a very hot commodity these days, and it's good that this issue is getting more of it, but it would appear that action is arriving in the form of policy now. Tell me more about this task force, Danielle.
So before we get into that, it's worth mentioning that there does exist at the federal level a task force focused on missing Indigenous people. This was signed into law in 2020, and it was called Savannah's Act. That law stemmed from an incident you may remember that happened in Fargo back in 2017.
Yeah, I do recall that tragedy. I mean, my goodness, it was just one of the most horrifying stories that I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
That, if you don't remember, that was the young pregnant woman who went missing in the Fargo area. Heartbreaking ordeal, though.
Absolutely. And again, just to refresh any listeners' memories, Savannah Graywind was 8 months pregnant when her neighbor lured her to her apartment and ultimately murdered her before taking her daughter from her womb. The baby was found alive shortly afterwards and returned to Savannah's family. Both the woman and her boyfriend are now in prison for their roles in what happened. But that incident captured nationwide attention, probably because that sort of crime is relatively rare. But Savannah was Indigenous. North Dakota's former Senator Heidi Heitkamp was instrumental in getting Savannah's Act passed, which was aimed at improving collaboration between all levels of agencies when they respond to these missing person cases.
And now there's a state law about the same thing.
Yes. So Todd's story stated that the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission tracked 46 bills concerning the state's tribal communities, and House Bill 1199 was one of them. This is the bill that established the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force.
It's certainly worthwhile and vital for an issue as serious as people going missing to have, you know, every task force they can to focus on what's happening in these communities. How does the task force actually work?
So the law creates a criminal justice database, pretty much an information sharing system that's managed by the Attorney General's office. And the system will be able to be used across all the essential agencies involved in these cases. The task force will be chaired by the Attorney General, and the law says it needs to have members that include the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Chief of the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, Executive Director of the Indian Affairs Commission, the Superintendent of the Highway Patrol, and then representatives from each of the 5 recognized tribes.
Yeah, it sounds like it covers a lot of bases, and you would think that the latter, each of the 5 recognized tribes, would be the most important to balance out any sort of community distrust in law enforcement. That's sort of the first thing that comes to mind, that this task force is led by law enforcement, the top cop in the state.
Yes, absolutely. Tribal representation is absolutely key because, remember, these are the people that are most familiar with these communities. The task force will be working on identifying things like barriers between agencies and the tribal communities, as well as potential causes leading to the disappearances and strategies to work against those. And the task force will also be in charge of administering the Missing Indigenous People Grant Fund.
You know, along with federal law, this sounds really potentially good. I don't think we can work too hard when it comes to protecting our communities, especially those that are historically marginalized or at risk.
Todd included some remarks from Governor Kelly Armstrong at the conference in his report, and he sounded really optimistic about it as well.
Doing it with local law enforcement, collaborations with tribal, BIA, state, highway patrol, National Guard, and it's really, truly something that I think we are going to see almost an immediate impact, and we're going to continue to work with everybody to make sure it's implemented in the best way possible.
Yep, sounds like he's ready to hit the ground running.
And, you know, for many, it just can't come fast enough. Jody Rave Spotted Bear is founder and director of the Indigenous Media Freedom Alliance, which publishes the online news network Buffalo's Fire. She says 95% of these cases of missing Indigenous people go unreported in the media. Now, that's unreported, not underreported. And it may be because the information is just hard to get.
I've seen numbers saying right now there's maybe about 15 or 30, and then people are disputing those numbers again, which is why we need a more unified data system to really track in real time what is happening on the ground.
Wow. And so once the task force gets going, what are the next steps?
They'll be submitting their findings every August to legislative management, and the report will have to contain a number of things, including the number of Indigenous people that have gone missing, the number of people who have been found, and of course, all the details pertaining to those cases. The report should also include recommendations they have or any other activities they've undertaken and with whom.
Well, okay, so when are they going to get started on this?
The law takes effect July 1st, so presumably they'll be getting underway in just a couple of weeks here.
Yeah, good. Not a moment too soon. I know this has been traumatic for so many who live on our reservations here in North Dakota and elsewhere, too. Lots of places, you know, you and I were talking the other day about Canada and the problems that they face up there with their First Nations community. Certainly a worthwhile cause to focus some attention and government power to.
Absolutely. And definitely make sure to give Todd's story a listen in our Prairie Public Newsroom.
And speaking of Prairie Public Newsroom, Buffalo's Fire, Jody Ray Spotted Bear's news site, we have a link to that. We have some stories that you'll see in our news feed. So check that out, too, the Prairie Public Newsroom at prairiepublic.org. Well, Danielle, since we're on the topic of our Prairie Public Newsroom, now it's time where we take a bite-sized look at some other stories that are happening in this region. What else are you guys taking a look at?
So here are this week's three leads. Number one, North Dakota is seeing a return to warmer weather this week, and smoke from wildfires from Canada has moved in with it. Last week's episode discussed fires in Manitoba sending smoke to North Dakota. This week, those fires are happening in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Number two, no new measles cases have been confirmed in North Dakota in 2 weeks.
Woo-hoo!
This is also an update on a prior episode. Measles is very contagious, and North Dakota was reported to have the highest rate of measles infection in the country. But Health and Human Services has not confirmed any new cases since May 28th.
All right, hopefully we're going down in those rankings.
And number three, massive fires swept across western North Dakota only a few months ago. Now the people of Ray in the northwestern part of the state are working hard on moving on. This was an excellent follow-up piece produced by Katie David about how citizens of Ray are moving on after last fall's deadly fire.
Man, you guys in the newsroom have been pretty busy lately, driving all over the state for some of these stories. Thanks again for all that, Danielle.
Absolutely. And make sure you check out our newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org to check out these and other stories from the Prairie Public News team.
All right, that'll do it for this week's episode of Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That was episode 5 of our newscast, Prairie Beat. You can listen anytime at prairiepublic.org, or you can subscribe to Prairie Beat wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2025 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 11th. What are the odds of three men named Charles being killed by a single lightning strike at the same place and time? Charles Smith and Charles Walter were killed instantly while erecting a circus tent in Wahpeton. Foreman Charles Miller died later from his injuries. Of all the mysterious legends surrounding the event, the mathematical probability has never been addressed. It remains an unsolved footnote. Reports vary on how many men and boys were working to raise the big top. One account said 22 men were erecting the center pole when it was shattered by lightning. A dozen were knocked senseless. Still, the tent was raised and the show went on, with 7,000 people attending. A collection was taken up for a proper funeral with a hearse and a clergyman. The two men were buried that same day at nearby Riverside Cemetery, also known as the Bohemian Cemetery. The broken circus pole served as a temporary grave marker. A few months later, an impressive granite monument was erected. The base is shaped to represent the canvas tent, from which the broken center pole rises. Engraved in the granite sculpture are images of lightning, chains, ropes, and pulleys. Travelers and circus people visited the grave each year, leaving flowers and trinkets by the monument. Some locals call it the elephant's grave. Others believed it was the resting place of a Romani king or a Bohemian magician. To this day, floral tributes and balloons still appear at the circus monument in the old cemetery south of town. On this date in 1897, the Richland County Gazette reported that the Ringling Brothers Circus Parade, held the previous day, June 10th, was the largest and finest ever seen in the city. Among the marvels, 205 beautiful white horses, 12 elephants, 5 camels, 1 calliope, 1 chime of bells, 4 bands, 51 carriages, and 32 small ponies. The Wahpeton Times wrote, "The Ringling Brothers have a right to claim the greatest show on earth. The parade is simply immense." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm John Donvan. It might feel like the country is being torn apart right now and that there's no room for civil conversation anymore. I would argue, not so. On the program I host, Open to Debate, there is still a place for spirited, respectful, persuasive dialogue that might even change your mind on an issue or two. And that's a throwback we can all use these days. Listen to Open to Debate, now on Sundays at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on member-supported Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you very much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, our movie reviewer extraordinaire, Matt Olean, stops by the Main Street studio. This week's movie, The Phoenician Scheme. It's a funky comedy, and we'll get Matt's advice on whether this is one to go watch. Matt and I will also ask the question, who's the greatest female movie star of all time? And we'll backtrack to last week's discussion. Matt may have forgot one of the great male movie stars. Plus, our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, he and I will review this week's news. We would love for you to listen to Main Street as a podcast. You can get Main Street wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Until tomorrow, we hope you have a wonderful rest of your Wednesday, and we look forward to seeing you again.